I believe 1 Kings 3:16 is where I left off. At least that's what I wrote down, if that makes sense to everyone else. I think that where we were was Solomon had a dream, and God had told him he had become king. He had a dream, and God said to him, you know, Solomon, what do you want? Which is a beautiful little question, what do you want? And it's a tough one for all of us. If God were to come to you and say, you can have anything you want, what is it? And let me ask you, if God showed up and said you could have anything you want, what would it be?
Peace.
He can do that.
Nachos.
A thousand more wishes, yeah.
Taco Bell had free tacos today.
See, God provided and you weren't paying attention. Your wish is gone. Not really. I mean, if you ever really give a thought and God said to you, anything you want, and you know, that would be a hard thing to answer really quick. Or maybe it'd be something easy to answer really quick, I guess, if you've given it thought. Mike and I were talking on the way over. I says, just to be free from being me. You know, and to me, that's heaven. To not have to deal with the flesh. To let the spirit run rampant and do all the things that the spirit wants to do and the flesh stops. To me, everything else is going to happen. You know, and I know this is going to happen too, but I would really like to have it happen now so that I would be less of me and more of him. Well, I guess the thing is conform to the image of Christ more than what I am now. Because once you're that, the other stuff don't matter. Honestly, I can't think of anything else that I would want more than that. But Solomon had a great answer. He had been given a great charge, and he said, God, help me to do what you've given me to do. And God appreciated that, and God said, I'm going to give you that, and I'm going to give you some other things too. Some were conditional, some were not. So after that, and this happens in a dream, and like I said, God in many places talks to people in dreams. This was a two-way conversation in a dream, which I think may be the only time I can think of in Scripture where people, instead of it's God just talking, he's responding. They're having holding a conversation.
I think my problem that springs to mind is just the initial thought of, you know, asking what you would want. Doesn't quite align with what I would like after I think about it a minute. You know?
Right.
A gut reaction answer is vastly different.
It's a pretty deep question, actually.
Yeah, and my initial answer is not very deep. So it's like, you know, I would like to get to the point where my immediate reaction is the deep,
right, because I'm already thinking there. Right, I agree. I know what you mean. But I guess your answer says a lot about where you are. And apparently, he has been worrying about this. You know, he's looked out and said, whoa, look at all this. And so the reason he asked for that is becomes known to us immediately. He's the place where the buck stops. Just like with Paul, who appealed to Caesar, you could appeal to the king, anything that's going on. It's its own system of justice. Justice in the end, I mean, justice can be handled before it gets to him. But you can, just like here, you can appeal all the way to the Supreme Court. Well, you can appeal all the way to the king. And so as soon as he asked for this, this is what the next thing that happens is. Then two women who were harlots, I'm not quite sure, I guess that's telling us something about their character, I'm not sure why it's in there, came to the king and stood before him. The one woman said, O my lord, this woman and I live in the same house, and I gave birth to a child while she was in the house. It happened on the third day after I gave birth that this woman also gave birth to a child, and we were together. There was no stranger with us in the house, only the two of us in the house. Well, apparently there was someone else before this, but at this point there isn't. This woman's son died in the night because she lay on it. So she arose in the middle of the night and took my son from beside me while your maidservant slept, and laid him on our bosom and laid her dead son in mine. When I rose in the morning to nurse my son, behold, he was dead. But when I looked at him carefully in the morning, behold, he was not my son whom I had born. The other woman said, No, for the living one is my son, and the dead one is your son. But the first woman said, no, for the dead one is your son and the living one is my son. Thus they spoke before the king. The king said, the one says, this my son who is living, and your son is the dead one. And the other says, no, for your son is the dead one, and my son is living. The king said, get me a sword. So they brought a sword before the king. The king said, divide the living child in two, give half to the one and half to the other. Then the woman whose child was the living one spoke to the king, for she was deeply stirred over her son, and said, O my lord, give her the living child, by no means kill him. But the other said, he shall be neither mine nor yours, divide him. The king said, give the first woman the living child, and by no means kill him, she is his mother. When all of Israel heard this judgment, which the king had handed down, they feared the king, for they saw the wisdom of God was with him to administer justice. It seems rather simple to us, but this is his first big public deal. And everybody's gathering around to see what this is a big thing. They're gathering around to see what he's going to do. And I'm sure with his first words, people were taken back. You know, give me a sword, cut him in half, and that'll take care of this deal, which was never his intention. And it worked like a charm. It seems rather simplistic, but its effect on what's important here is the effect on the people. That the most important thing here, well, also for the mother whose child it was, I'm assuming it was extremely important for her. But the effect that most of the beautiful and wise things are extremely simple. As the things become more complex, you know, the trouble starts to stir. And what he did there gave him standing among the people. Word spread to everywhere. You know, you can bring your stuff here. He is not going to let his... There were judges that I've been before that I did not want to go before, just because their mood, their attitude, and their preconceived notions seemed to taint the whole thing for me. If they were in a bad mood, you know, everybody suffered for it. I'm the judge. I can do what I want. And this power that he has is absolute. So when you know that the person who has absolute power over you and your decisions is thinking things through, he's being wise, he's not getting emotionally attached, he's doing the right thing, this has to send a huge comfort through the people. And it's this fear of the Lord thing. It means they were in awe. They recognized, and that has to be such a source of comfort to you, to know that when people become people, and bad things happen, and it has to be straightened out, that ultimately the person who's going to do this is a good person. So this first one is a beautiful case, and it's much deeper than just him settling this. This is establishing him as the judge in the nation. Okay, chapter 4. Now King Solomon was king over all of Israel. These were his officials. Azariah, the son of Zadok, was the priest. He would be the priest in the new temple. This would be the priest that handles the temple of God. And when they say the priest, they're meaning the high priest, which makes a difference because the person who is the high priest is the only one who can go into the Holy of Holies. That's the person that takes the sacrifices in, that goes in where the Ark of the Covenant is, the tabernacle of the Lord. He's the only one that's supposed to go in there. It matters. And finally, this issue has been settled. Oh, remember, all this time during David, there were two high priests where there really shouldn't have been. So this is a big step. Elihoreph and Ahijah, the sons of him too, were secretaries. Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was the recorder. This was also David's recorder, by the way. It's the same one that he had. Do I hear music? I have accompaniment. And Benaniah, the son of Jehoiada, was over the army, and Zadok and Abiathar were priests. They weren't the priest. It makes a difference. Ahaziah, the son of Nathan, was over the deputies, and Zabud, the son of Nathan, was a priest, was the king's friend. Nathan was also the prophet. Nathan has to be getting pretty old about now. And Ahashara over the household, and Adorama, the son of Abda over the men of forced labor. Solomon had 12 deputies over all of Israel who provided for the king and his household. Each man had to provide a month in the year. And their names were, and it tells their names, I'm not going to read all of them. Benaniah, verse 11, in the height of Dor. Tabitha, Taphath, yeah, T-A-P-H-A-H, Taphath, the daughter of Solomon, was his wife. There are several in here that are in-laws. The wonders of politics. These are old close friends. These are son-in-laws. These are people that he just sticks in. Now, this 12 deputies, these are not 12 tribes. These are 12 regions that he picked up. This isn't, you would think the easiest way to do this would just be one guy over each of the tribes. He breaks it up into 12 municipalities that are not in line with the tribes, from my understanding. And so each one gets taxed 1 month. It is each one of these municipalities' responsibilities and is these guys' responsibilities to see to it that it gets done, to take care of the palace and the king's needs. So basically, for 1 month out of every year, the region you live in has to send whatever the king needs to keep his palace and his thousand wives and the temple and his wives' places. And remember all the stuff that Samuel warned Israel about? That's going to keep coming up. Honestly, when he said, you know, you don't want a king, and they said, oh, yeah, we do. And he said, here's why you don't want one. Well, here it is. This is one of the reasons. Let's move on to, it's a bunch of names of people we don't know or won't know anymore. Also in 15, Ahaziah also married one of his daughters. And it goes on to pick up a 20. And we'll be done with the names of all the people who are running the government. There are people who know who all these people are. I do not know who they are. Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sands that is on the seashore in abundance. They were eating, drinking, and rejoicing. This is what David never got to see. Things are wonderful. Can anybody go to Genesis 22:17? And somebody else to 32:12. Because this isn't just a phrase that was picked and used. This phrase was used for a reason. Anybody got 22:17? I mean, how can you even read that?
I have 32.
22:17 and 32:12. Whoever has 32:12, go ahead, read it.
But you have said, I will surely make you prosper and will make your descendants like the sand of the sea, which cannot be counted.
Which is pretty much what 22:17 says. Once again, this is fulfillment of prophecy. This isn't just a casual set of words thrown down. They're saying, wow, there's a whole bunch of folks there. This is saying that what God told Abraham is happening. It has happened now. He said, when I said it was going to happen, well, here it is. And, of course, it becomes much more than this. And the eating and drinking and rejoicing, which is what God said that Solomon would have, that he would have peace, he would be able to build and prosper because he would not be at war as David was. He's getting all the benefit of David and not having to fight any of the fights or anything like that. Now Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the river to the land of the Philistines, to the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. We won't go there, but if you check Genesis 15:8 and Joshua 1:4, you will also see that this is a fulfillment of prophecy. The river is the Euphrates, and it's from the Euphrates to the Nile, and it's from the Mediterranean in. That's what was promised. That's what he got. It is exactly what Abraham was told he would get. And here it is. Solomon's provision for one day was 30 cores of fine flour and 60 cores of meal. One core is supposed to equal 10 bushels. Yeah.
What is a bushel?
I couldn't even tell you. A bushel is a whole, like a bushel of corn. Like in Lancaster, I can't remember how many bushels of corn they got out of an acre. but it's a whole lot. Think of it as being more than a 55-gallon drum. What the actual dimensions of a bushel are, I'm assuming it means the same, but the translation I got is, so 30 bushels, 30 cores, 300 bushels is what this is for one day.
It is 195 bushels of fine flour and 390 bushels of meal.
Now, when you run into a cores, now remember this, whenever we start dealing with measurements, there's the Philistine measurement of a core, there's the Hebrew, the only, especially cubits. There's a long cubit, there's a short cubit. So there is all, yeah. We can get into a ballpark.
Mine's the hippie version.
Mine Yours is the hippie version, right? So
5.5 tons.
Well, I like that one. Wow. That this is a day.
30 cores of the finest flour, so 5.5 tons.
Right, which would be, if one core equals 10 bushels and there's 30 cores, that's 300 bushels, which would be 5.5. Think about this. That's just that. This is what it's taking to feed his household and to run his government. This, yeah, he's got a lot of friends. You think he'd need a bigger ping pong table. This ain't flying here. And 60 cores of meal, 10 fat oxen. Have you ever ordered a side of beef? Have you ever gotten beef wholesale? I mean, and filled your freezer up? A half a cow is a whole lot. I mean, you're eating for a year on a half a cow. And 10 a day. 20 pasture-fed oxen. So there was 10 grain-fed, and then there was 20 pasture-fed, the cheap ones. I guess they went to his in-laws. 100 sheep beside deer, gazelles, roebuck, and fatted fowl. Wow. I mean, I can't even imagine this. I'm guessing what it would take to feed the people in Heinz Field. You know, what you're looking at here. I don't know. I don't even know how to put that sort of volume into perspective of what 50,000 people, 40,000 people, or I don't know. Anyway, but the people are paying for this. That's who's ponying up. That's where these cows just aren't magically appearing. And this all goes back to Samuel telling them, he's going to take your cows. Okay. For he had dominion over everything west of the river, that is Euphrates, from Tifsa even to Gaza, over the kings. Gaza is over on the where the Phoenicians are, over all the kings of the west of the river, and he had peace on all sides around him. Things are really, really good. Well, for him they are. I'm assuming they're pretty good for Israel because they don't have to go out and fight the Philistines every 3 weeks. So Judah and Israel lived in safety, every man under his vine, his fig tree, from Dan to Beersheba, all the days of Solomon. It is very easy to take this for granted. A lot of these people that are alive know that this isn't how it always is. And to be honest, since World War II, well, actually probably since Vietnam, we have been in relative peace. We have been very fortunate. We have been blessed. And I take nothing away from the young men that are serving us right now. But if you consider the volume of what all-out war is, you know, we have been extremely blessed because people are willing to fight a fight to stop it from becoming a bigger one. You know, we have been blessed by their sacrifice. But
how long was the days of Solomon doing?
Solomon lived to be 70. I think his reign was about 40 years. I can't remember. I said it last week. Don't remember what it was. It was relatively short. And then it... Well, as always, when you live in peace, you seem to forget God. When things are really good, which tells us something about us, that most of the time our pursuit of God is because we need something. And I've always said that becoming a mature Christian is graduating from that and going to, what can I do for you, Lord, instead of give me this, give me that. You know, the difference between the mature Christian and the immature Christian, the milk and the meat, as Paul put it, you know, growing up in Christ. Problem is that these are the only things that keep us grounded in God, or the hard things, because when things are good, we forget them. Solomon had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots and 12,000 horsemen. Those deputies provided for King Solomon and all who came to the King Solomon's table. Each in his month, they left nothing lacking. They also brought barley and straw for the horses and swift steeds to the place where it should be, each according to his charge. Now God gave Solomon wisdom and very great discernment and breadth of mind like the sand that is on the seashore. Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the sons of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt. For he was wiser than all the men. Then Ethan, if you will take a look at Psalms, yeah, it's up to you on your own time, 89. He wrote Psalms 89. Ethan is a smart dude, and everybody knows he is. But so he gets pointed out. The Ezraite, then he names Haman. I don't even know who these people are, sons of Moab. And his fame was known in all the surrounding nations. He also spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,500. Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and the Songs of Solomon are pretty much written by him. Those are Solomon's works. If you want to do something fascinating, take a broad look at Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is one of the hardest, if you just open it up looking for scriptural wisdom, it might be one of the hardest books in the world to understand what in the world is he saying. But if you realize, once you start to learn a little bit about who Solomon is and how God is teaching him and how he's learning, you start to see Ecclesiastes as a man who got his wisdom and learning by trying things. And the book is nothing more than Solomon becoming wiser and wiser. I set my mind to know everything that could be known, which is almost what Descartes said, is it not? Before he climbed into the enclave of the stove. You know, I wanted to remove anything that, you know, had the possibility of not being true. And Solomon had the same adventure. Thing was with Solomon had the ability to follow all of his endeavors out to the ultimate extreme. He started with drinking. He tried work. He tried women. Boy, did he try women. He tried wisdom itself. And he works his way through that book, and you'll keep saying, what in the world is he talking about? What he's saying is, I've tried all these things. None of them satisfy me. Vanity of vanity. In other words, it's wasting. And then he tells you why it's wasting time. You know, because you're going to die. What difference does it make how much wealth you obtain? You know, some knucklehead's going to get it no matter what you build up. You don't know if your, what he says is, you don't know if your son's going to be an income poop. You did all this work, you built all this stuff up, he could may have it gone in 5 days. And everything he's saying is true. But people have a hard time with that book because they're thinking, is this what God wants me to believe? If you look at Ecclesiastes after we look at Solomon's life, the book will just seem even more vibrant. Because his conclusion is this, love the wife of your youth and serve your God. In the end, and this is also after Solomon, the wisest man that ever lived, has his downfall as he walks away from the Lord. It's fascinating to read that book with the understanding of Solomon, who he is and what he's dealing with. And the book starts to make a lot more sense. Also, all of us have to deal with this, the wages of sin. We live in a world that is cursed. Read, once you go to Genesis, read the curses that came with the fall. They're real. Every single day, every one of us deal with it. And one day, all of us are going to deal with the entirety of the curse. The ground is cursed. Work is cursed. Your relationship between husband and wife is cursed. Your life is cursed. You're going to die. All these things, every single day, you got to get up and deal with them. The difference is, as Christians, we live in the curse. We can have victory in the curse. You know, we can die in victory. We could work as unto the Lord. We could have our relationship between husband and wife be what it should be. You know, what did Christ say? Husbands, love your wives, obey your husbands. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. If both you were doing that, it works out really cool. And even death itself. Solomon is also trying to understand a cursed world. The things I see, put on the news, and you say to yourself, oh my God, how does this happen? Well, it's us. And if you look at the curses between our nature, who we are, and the curses that came with the fall, almost everything's explained. There is clarity there. And there's What amazes me is God's patience with us, because most of these things that happen, all he had to do for the curses to occur is let us be us. We are not very nice to each other. If you put on the TV and you see these horrible things that happened, it was us, it wasn't God. And Solomon sets out and tries to deal with these things. And Proverbs is pretty much cut and dry. Proverbs is, save the money, buy them, you'll ride your girl to Sunday school. That sort of stuff. You know, do whatever you got to do. Don't do this, do that. That's dumb. This is smart. You know, this will happen to you if you do that. Ecclesiastes is much more philosophical. It's him, the wisest man that ever lived, working through life and asking himself a question. What matters? What matters? Difference was when, and everybody asked themselves that question. Everybody. And you could look at your own life or the life of someone else if you know them enough and see how they've answered the question by how they live their life. My family is the most important thing to me, and you will live your, maybe my work's the most important thing to me. I've decided this is what life is about. I've decided this is what I should live for. Maybe money is. Maybe pleasure is. Maybe alcohol is. You know, maybe that feeling that I get is the most important thing. I haven't found anything that makes me, seems more important to me than feeling like that. Okay. As you work your way through all those things, it's exactly what he did, but he could do all of them to the utmost degree because he was the richest man alive. You know, sometimes when we try something and we think that's the most important thing and it fails, we can say to ourselves, well, I just didn't have enough money to make me happy. Or I didn't just have enough women to make me happy. Well, Solomon had 1,000 of them and he had more money than anybody else. And he came to the conclusion that giving me one more wife or another buck ain't going to change anything. They're not the problem. I'm attacking the wrong thing. So this wisdom of Solomon was not only granted by God, it's how God, I guess what I'm trying to say is this is how God grants wisdom. He teaches you. You learn it. The difference is he puts a spirit in you to want to learn it, to want to see, to want to know what the very right thing is. And if you have any doubts, peruse the book again, Ecclesiastes. We did this at Quinn's, the home study we have, Ecclesiastes. It took us 1.5 years to get through that book just because there were so many things you would say, why would he say that? And you have to, you know, because he's working through it. You have to see it as a beginning, a middle, and an end. But if you want to understand what they're talking about, all this stuff about the wisdom of Solomon, other than not cutting a baby in half, take a look at the book of Ecclesiastes, especially maybe once we're done with Solomon. On your own time, go take a look at it and try to understand how this works. Because God's doing it in your life too, the exact same way. You're learning to be wise. But you'll never learn to be wise until you want to be. What God is changing in all of us, and I know I've said this before, and I will try to remind you at least once every 3 months. What God is changing is what we want. Because until what you want, you will always pursue what you want. And you will never change until what you want changes. So what God is changing in you through experiences, through failures and through triumphs, through dumb mistakes, through pain, through ecstasy, is what you want. And the beauty of God is he will let you try the other things, just like Solomon did. He doesn't stop you. He already knows what's most important. He doesn't force it on us. That's the beauty of free will. Here's the world. I'm not going to stop you from doing any of it. You will suffer. It will hurt. But if you come to me, I will teach you from it. You will learn. And Solomon learned. And what he was given, each of us could be given. You know, just leave it to the Lord. He spoke of trees from the cedars that are in Lebanon, even to the hyssop which grows on the walls. He spoke of the animals, the birds, the creeping things, and the fish. Men came from all people who hear the wisdom of Solomon, from all the kings of the earth, to all to hear his wisdom. Now, Hiram, king of Tyre, sent his servants to Solomon. And when he heard that they had anointed him king in place of his father, for Hiram had always been a friend of David. Hiram is up north in Lebanon, which is what we would call it now, I believe, what would have been called Phoenicia then. They were a pretty smart group of folks. They were also extremely wealthy, wealthy from their trade. The Phoenicians were a cosmopolitan type of folk. They were everywhere. They had hands all across the Mediterranean, but they also had Lebanon, which was known for its trees. If you've ever seen pictures of Israel, tain't no trees. I mean, what they call a tree is what we would call a shrub or a bush. But up there, there are cedars. And cedar has, before womanized lumber, cedar was all you had. It had properties to repel rot and insect attack. I used to build decks out of cedar. I can remember going down to West Virginia and putting a deck on all cedar, and then womanized came out, you know, which would have lasted, you know, even 10 years longer. But cedar was prime. So not only do they have trade, not only do they have know-how, they have the trees, and they have the people that know how to do stuff with the trees. They cornered the market on craftsmanship. And Solomon sent word to Hiram saying, and he is basically a good friend of Israel. There is no hard feelings between them. He's been a friend of David. He helped David to build his palace. If we go back to when David built his place, this is the same guy that sent down craftsmen and sent down trees. You know that David, my father, was unable to build a house for the name of the Lord, his God, because of the wars which surrounded him until the Lord put under the soles of his feet. In other words, his enemies were crushed. But now the Lord my God has given me rest on every side. There is neither adversary nor misfortune. Behold, I intend to build a house for the name of the Lord my God, as the Lord spoke to David my father, saying, your son, whom I will set on your throne in your place, will build the house for my name. So what he's doing is he's catching Hiram up. He's letting him know that what I'm doing is a spiritual thing. This is what God wants me to do. It was my father's desire, which carries weight with Hiram because he was friends with him. Now therefore, command that they cut for me cedars of Lebanon. My servants will be with your servants, and I will give you wages for your servants according to all that you say. For now you know that there is no one among us who knows how to cut timber like the Sidonians. So what he's saying, that, you know, this is a timber for wheat deal, basically. He says, I will give you wages. He offered, what he says to him is, tell me what you want. You know, you do this for me, and then you set your price. And Hiram heard the words of Solomon. He rejoiced greatly and said, blessed be the Lord today. Which is interesting because we have no idea of the spirituality of the Phoenicians, of Hiram. But I don't know whether he's acknowledging what he knows or what he's acknowledging what Solomon said. He could just be saying, you know, may your God bless you. Or if he's saying, you know, God is good. Maybe he recognizes the same God. There are always people out there. Remember, before Israel showed up, these were all people that God created. Some had lost their way. Israel was specifically created as a nation so that people would know who God was, because they had forgotten. But if you will remember, even Moses' father-in-law, was it Abner? Who was a heathen living up in the mountains, came down and it says he was a priest before the Lord. He was not of Israel. He had never forgotten who God was. You know, and he'd actually helped. So these people are out there. And he said, and behold, I'm to the house. Okay. Now, therefore, command that he cut. Okay. When Hiram heard the words of Solomon, he rejoiced greatly and said, bless the Lord today, who has given David a wise son over this great people. So Hiram sent word to Solomon, saying, I have heard the message which you have sent me. I will do what you desire concerning the cedars and cypress timbers. My servants will bring them down from Lebanon to the sea, and I will make them into rafts to go down by sea to the place where you direct me, and I will have them broken up there, and you will carry them away. Then you shall accomplish my desire by giving food to my household. Lebanon, because it has trees and big mountains, really doesn't have much agriculture, because they have trees and big mountains. So what he's saying is, you give me what you got, and I'll give you what I got, and I'll be happy. He doesn't want money, he wants food. So Hiram gave Solomon as much as he desired of the cedars and cypress timbers. Solomon gave Hiram 20,000 cores of wheat. Now, if 300 was 5 tons.
3,600 tons.
Whoa. Whoa. You doing a math over there? Is that written in there? Okay. Yeah. Okay. Right. Wow. Okay. Tons. 3,600 tons of wheat as food for his household and 20 cores of beaten oil. I don't know what that means, but I'm assuming it's... Yeah, that's what I assumed it was. They would get the olives and put them in a press and crush it down, and I assume it was extremely expensive. Thus Solomon would give Hiram year by year. The Lord gave wisdom to Solomon just as he had promised him, and there was peace between Hiram and Solomon. The two of them made a covenant. Now King Solomon levied forced laborers from all of Israel. Let's go back to Samuel's warning. Samuel said, he will take your sons, he will take your daughters, and he will have them do labor. It's happening. And it says, from all of Israel, and the labored force was 30,000 men. It was a work tax. You were taxed by having to go to work. These were forced laborers. This wasn't, hey, here's $100, come do this. This is, here's what you're doing. He sent them to Lebanon, 10,000 a month in relays. They were in Lebanon a month and 2 months at home. And Adoram, who was over the forced laborers. Now Solomon had 70,000 transporters, 80,000 ewers of stone in the mountains. Besides, Solomon had 3,300 chief deputies, foremen, who were over the project and who ruled over the people who were doing the work. That's also, these would generally be considered outsiders. The people doing the work would generally also be considered the slave labor. I think the number has come out to be, if you look at 2 Corinthians 2:17, it will tell you, 2 Chronicles 2:17, it tells you it was 150,000 slave laborers. So we've got 70, we got 80, we got 10,000 a year, we got, this is a public works project of massive scale for such a small nation. Then the king commanded, and they quarried the great stones, costly stones, to lay the foundation of the house with cut stones. So Solomon's builders and Hiram's builders and the Gebalites, were craftsmen that were even further north than Hiram, than Tyre. They were Phoenicians also, but they were really good at what they did. Cut them and prepared the timbers and the stones to build the house. And we'll wrap up there. Any questions?